Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today on Memorial Day, we will present a special program to commemorate the 100th birthday of Benjamin Britten, whose great work, the Latin Mass for the Dead, War Requiem, was commissioned to consecrate the rebuilt Coventry Cathedral that was destroyed by German bombers in World War II. As a result of the destruction and the death of close friends in the First World War, Britten became a pacifist, and his War Requiem was inspired by the poems of Wilfred Owen, who was killed in World War I, 1 week before the armistice that ended the Great War, the war to end all wars. And as we approach the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of World War I, many contemporary scholars and historians are pointing to the similarities of the diplomatic failures and entangling alliances back then to the volatile situation in Ukraine, where the all but moribund NATO alliance is facing a possible confrontation with Vladimir Putin's more assertive Russia. And in the Far East, China and countries with whom the U.S. has alliances like Japan are facing off over piles of rock and uninhabited islands in the South China Sea that could trigger a wider confrontation between the world's leading powers if brinkmanship over territorial disputes erupt and drag the world into a catastrophic conflagration, as happened during that fateful August 100 years ago. Today's program is called The Pity of War, and it was performed at the UCLA Hammer Museum in Los Angeles by British stage and screen actress Rosalind Ayres and her husband, actor and director Martin Jarvis. They will read a selection of poems from World War I and World War II that depict the horror and futility of war, not the jingoistic patriotic verse that accompanied these massive tragedies, the first of which ended in an armistice 95 years ago today, an armistice in which historians have observed the seeds of World War II were sown out of the punitive reparations imposed on Germany by the victorious Allies, since at the very same spot the armistice was signed, 22 years later, Adolf Hitler staged the signing of France's surrender to Germany in World War II. And now, following a few refrains of Benjamin Britten's War Requiem, we'll begin The Pity of War, poems of World War I and World War II, read by Martin Jarvis and Rosalind Ayres.
Thank you for inviting Martin and me to this marvelous museum and for allowing us to share these poems with you, written by some of our greatest poets. Together, across two world wars, through their emotional and often uniquely personal writings, they've bequeathed a unique and astonishingly graphic collection of word pictures to communicate aspects of World War I and World War II.
And just to say, we've very much enjoyed working with Claudia Bestor and Stephen Yeltsa in identifying some of the works that can best convey something of the horror, and the human tragedy, the quiet heroism, even sometimes the humor, and crucially, the pity of war. And the first poem is by the great British novelist and poet Thomas Hardy, who was born in the west of England in 1828 and who wrote this piece at the outbreak of the First World War in 1914, when he was in his 70s. It seems to be narrated by those from previous generations, already long dead, who've been awakened in their coffins by the sound of guns, and it's called Channel Firing.
That night, your great guns, unawares, shook all our coffins as we lay and broke the chancel window squares. We thought it was the judgment day and sat upright, while drearisome arose the howl of awakened hounds. The mouse let fall the autumn crumbs. The worms drew back into the mounds. The glebe cow drooled till God called...
No, it's gunnery practice out at sea, just as before you went below. The world is as it used to be, and all nations striving strong to make red war yet redder. Mad as hatters, they do no more, for Christ's sake, than you. who are helpless in such matters, that this is not the judgment hour, for some of them's a blessed thing. For if it were, they'd have to scour hell's floor for so much threatening. Aha, it will be warmer when I blow the trumpet, if indeed I ever do, for you are men, and rest eternal sorely need.
So down we lay again.
I wonder, will the world ever saner be?
Said one.
Than when he sent us under in our indifferent century.
And many a skeleton shook his head.
Instead of preaching 40 years...
My neighbour, Parson Thirdly, said...
I wish I'd stuck to pipes and beer.
Again the guns disturbed the hour, roaring their readiness to avenge.
As far inland as Stourton Tower and Camelot and starlit Stonehenge. And now a young poet, again writing in the first year of World War I, Rupert Brooke. He's known, of course, for the great poem Grantchester. Still stands the clock at 2:50, and is there honey still for tea? And for perhaps his most famous work, Home Thoughts from Abroad, which you may remember begins, "Oh, to be in England now that April's there." He died in the second year of the war, in April 1915. He was 28.
He called this poem The Dead. These hearts were woven of human joys and cares, washed marvelously with sorrow, swift to mirth. The years had given them kindness. Dawn was theirs, and sunset, and the colours of the earth. These had seen movement and heard music, known slumber and waking, loved, gone proudly friended, felt the quick stir of wonder, sat alone, touched flowers and furs and cheeks. All this is ended. There are waters blown by changing winds to laughter and lit by rich skies all day, and after, frost, with a gesture, stays the waves that dance and wandering loveliness. He leaves a white, unbroken glory, a gathered radiance, a width, a shining peace under the night.
Wilfred Owen was born in 1893. He was 21 when the war started. He's often regarded as the finest of the First World War poets. His poems are distinguished by their sardonic vision, a certain anger and resentment, and a despair of British political attitudes. He's less obviously patriotic than Brooke, and his work's characterized by a kind of brutally honest passion. In the preface to an early collection of his work, he wrote, "My subject is war and the pity of war. The poetry is in the pity."
In 1961, the composer Benjamin Britten took 9 of Owen's poems and set them to music as a central part of his War Requiem. Many of you will know that this outstanding work will be performed on November 25th at the Walt Disney Concert Hall. Here are those 9 remarkable poems.
And the first is Anthem for Doomed Youth. What passing bells for these who die as cattle? Only the monstrous anger of the guns. Only the stuttering rifle's rapid rattle can patter out their hasty orisons. No mockeries now for them, no prayers nor bells, nor any voice of mourning save the choirs, the shrill, demented choirs of wailing shells and bugles calling for them from sad shires. What candles may be held to speed them all? Not in the hands of boys, but in their eyes shall shine the holy glimmers of goodbyes. The pallor of girls' brows shall be their pall, their flowers, the tenderness of patient minds, and each slow dusk, a drawing down of blinds.
Bugles sang. Bugles sang, saddening the evening air, and bugles answered, sorrowful to hear. Voices of boys were by the riverside. Sleep mothered them and left the twilight sad. The shadow of the morrow weighed on men. Voices of old despondency, resigned, bowed by the shadow of the morrow, slept.
And now a poem called The Next War, where I think Owen was influenced by his friend and mentor Siegfried Sassoon, also a great poet of the First World War, and who often wrote in a deceptively lighter vein. Here's Owen's The Next War. Out there, we've walked quite friendly up to death, sat down and eaten with him, cool and bland, pardoned his spilling mess tins in our hand. We've sniffed the green thick odour of his breath. Our eyes wept, but our courage didn't writhe. He's spat at us with bullets, and he's coughed shrapnel. We chorused when he sang aloft. We whistled while he shaved us with his scythe. Oh, death was never enemy of ours. We laughed at him. We leagued with him, old chum. No soldiers paid to kick against his powers. We laughed, knowing that better men would come and greater wars, when each proud fighter brags he wars on death for lives, not men for flags.
Futility. Move him into the sun. Gently its touch awoke him once, at home, whispering of fields unsown. Always it woke him, even in France, until this morning and this snow. If anything might rouse him now, the kind old sun will know. Think how it wakes the seeds, woke once the clay of a cold star. Our limbs so dear achieved, our sides full-nerved, still warm, too hard to stir. Was it for this the clay grew tall? Oh, what made fatuous sunbeams toil to break the earth's sleep at all?
And here Owen shows his ambivalent attitude to weaponry. He called it On Seeing a Piece of Our Heavy Artillery Brought into Action. Be slowly lifted up, thou long black arm, great gun towering towards heaven, about to curse, sway steep against them, and for years rehearse huge imprecations like a blasting charm. Reach at that arrogance which needs thy harm and beat it down before its sins grow worse. Spend our resentment, cannon. Yea, disperse our gold in shapes of flame, our breaths in storm. Yet, for men's sakes, whom thy vast malison must wither innocent of enmity, be not withdrawn, dark arm, thy spoilier done, safe to the bosom of our prosperity. But when thy spell be cast complete and whole, may God curse thee and cut thee from our soul.
The parable of the old man and the young.
So Abram rose and clave the wood and went and took the fire with him and a knife. And as they sojourned, both of them together, Isaac the firstborn spake and said,
My father, behold the preparations, fire and iron, but where the lamb for this burnt offering?
Then Abram bound the youth with belts and straps, and builded parapets and trenches there, and stretched forth the knife to slay his son. When lo, an angel called him out of heaven, saying,
Lay not thy hand upon the lad, neither do anything to him. Behold, a ram caught in the thicket by its horns. Offer the ram of pride instead of him.
But the old man would not so, but slew his son and half the seed of Europe, one by one.
And now his poem called The End.
After the blast of lightning from the east, the flourish of loud clouds, the chariot throne, after the drums of time have rolled and ceased, and from the bronze west long retreat is blown, shall life renew these bodies? Of a truth, all death will he annul, all tears assuage, or fill these void veins full again with youth, and wash with an immortal water, age. When I do ask white age, he saith, not so. My head hangs, weighed with snow. And when I hearken to the earth, she saith, my fiery heart sinks, aching. It is death. Mine ancient scars shall not be glorified, nor my titanic tears, the seas, be dried.
The next poem is called At a Calvary Near the Ancre. The Ancre was where the final stages of the Battle of the Somme was fought. By the end of this three-month battle, the British army had lost 420,000 men, 60,000 on the first day. The French lost 200,000, and the Germans 500,000. At a Calvary near the Ancre. One ever hangs where shelled roads part. In this war, he too lost a limb, but his disciples hide apart, and now the soldiers bear with him. Near Golgotha strolls many a priest, and in their faces there is pride that they were flesh marked by the beast by whom the gentle Christ's denied. The scribes on all the people shove and bawl allegiance to the state. But they who love the greater love lay down their life. They do not hate. And now the last of these extraordinary poems. Strange meeting.
It seemed that out of battle I escaped down some profound dull tunnel, long since scooped through granites, which titanic wars had groined. Yet also there, encumbered sleepers groaned, too fast in thought or death to be bestirred. Then, as I probed them, one sprang up and stared with piteous recognition in fixed eyes, lifting distressful hands as if to bless. And by his smile I knew that sullen hall. By his dead smile I knew we stood in hell. With a thousand pains that vision's face was grained, yet no blood reached there from the upper ground, and no guns thumped or down the flues made moan. Strange friend, I said, here is no cause to mourn. None, said that other, save the undone years, the hopelessness. Whatever hope is yours was my life also. I went hunting wild after the wildest beauty in the world, which lies not calm in eyes or braided hair, but mocks the steady running of the hour. And if it grieves, grieves richlier than here. For of my glee might many men have laughed, and of my weeping something had been left, which must die now. I mean the truth untold, the pity of war, the pity war distilled. Now men will go content with what we have spoiled, or discontent boil bloody and be spilled. They will be swift with the swiftness of the tigress. None will break ranks, though nations trek from progress. Courage was mine, and I had mystery. Wisdom was mine, and I had mastery to miss the march of this retreating world into vain citadels that are not walled. Then, when much blood had clogged their chariot wheels, I would go up and wash them from sweet wells, even with truths that lie too deep for taint. I would have poured my spirit without stint, but not through wounds, not on the cess of war. Foreheads of men have bled where no wounds were. I am the enemy you killed, my friend. I knew you in this dark, for so you frowned yesterday through me as you jabbed and killed. I parried, but my hands were loath and cold. Let us sleep now.
We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with the special Memorial Day programming, The Pity of War. Welcome back. This is Background Briefing, and today we're presenting a special Memorial Day program, The Pity of War. We'll begin now with more of The Pity of War, poems of World War I and World War II, read by Martin Jarvis and Rosalind Ayres.
Most of Wilfred Owen's poems were published posthumously. He was killed in action in France in 1918, just 1 week before the armistice.
He was 25.
Ezra Pound, American poet and critic, worked in London and Paris in the early 20th century as a foreign editor of American literary magazines. He became influential in developing the work of contemporaries such as T.S. Eliot, Robert Frost, and Ernest Hemingway, who wrote of Pound in 1925.
He defends his friends when they are attacked. He gets them into magazines and out of jail. He introduces them to wealthy women. He sits up all night with them when they claim to be dying. He advances them hospital expenses and dissuades them from suicide.
Outraged by the vast loss of life during the First World War, he lost faith in England, blaming the war on usury and international capitalism. In his 1920 poem, Hugh Selwyn Morbury, he wrote about the waste of life on the battlefield and of his anger at the hypocrisy of our leaders. Here are two stanzas. These fought in any case, and some believing pro domo in any case. Some quick to arm, some for adventure, some for fear of weakness, some from fear of censure, some for love of slaughter in imagination, learning later. Some in fear, learning love of slaughter. Died some pro patria, non dulce, non et decor. Walked eye deep in hell, believing in old men's lies. Then unbelieving came home, home to a lie, home to many deceits, home to old lies and new infamy, usury, age old and age thick, and liars in public places. daring as never before, wastage as never before. Young blood and high blood, fair cheeks and fine bodies, fortitude as never before, frankness as never before, disillusioned as never told in the old days, hysterias, trench confessions, laughter out of dead bellies. There died a myriad, and of the best among them. For an old bitch gone in the teeth, for a botched civilization. Charm smiling at the good mouth, quick eyes gone under Earth's lid. For too gross of broken statues, for a few thousand battered books.
Isaac Rosenberg, a Russian Jew who grew up as a Cockney in London's East End, was equally critical of the war. His wry style comes through strongly in Break of Day in the Trenches. The darkness crumbles away. It is the same old druid time as ever, only a live thing leaps my hand. A queer sardonic rat, as I pull the parapet's poppy to stick behind my ear. Droll rat, they would shoot you if they knew your cosmopolitan sympathies. Now you have touched this English hand, you will do the same to a German soon, no doubt, if it be your pleasure to cross the sleeping green between. It seems you inwardly grin as you pass strong eyes, fine limbs, haughty athletes, less chanced than you for life, bonds to the whims of murder, sprawled in the bowels of the earth, the torn fields of France. What do you see in our eyes? At the shrieking iron and flame hurled through still heavens? What quaver? What heart aghast? Poppies, whose roots are in men's veins, drop and are ever dropping. But mine, in my ear, is safe. Just a little white with the dust.
Like Rupert Brooke, Rosenberg was killed in action in April 1918. Here's a poem of optimism, written by Charlotte Mary Mew. She was a much admired but impoverished writer in England. And she wrote this when she was 44. It's called May 1915. Let us remember, spring will come again to the scorched, blackened woods where the wounded trees wait with their old, wise patience for the heavenly rain, sure of the sky, sure of the sea to send its healing breeze, sure of the sun. And even as to these, surely the spring, when God shall please, will come again, like a divine surprise to those who sit today with their great dead, hands in their hands, eyes in their eyes, at one with love, at one with grief, blind to the scattered things and changing skies.
And actually, despite that sense of hope, sadly, Charlotte Mew committed suicide some 13 years later. In 1918, when the great Irish poet and founder of the Abbey Theatre in Dublin, W.B. Yeats, was almost 80, he wrote a marvellously observant short piece in which he gets into the mindset of a young man who loves flying. An Irish airman foresees his death. I know that I shall meet my fate somewhere among the clouds above. Those that I fight, I do not hate. Those that I guard, I do not love. My country is Kiltartan Cross. My countrymen, Kiltartans poor, no likely end could bring them loss or leave them happier than before. Nor law nor duty bade me fight, nor public man nor cheering crowds. A lonely impulse of delight drove to this tumult in the clouds. I balanced all, brought all to mind. The years to come seemed waste of breath, a waste of breath the years behind, in balance with this life, this death.
Mademoiselle from Armentières was a popular song sung by the troops and sometimes even by those at home in World War I. It's also known by its semi-French chorus, Hinky Dinky Parlez-vous.
Nobody really knows who wrote it, and there are different versions. It was considered somewhat risque, and later, when sung on the radio and television, and even in the Waltons, typically only the first verse was permitted. Was it very risque? We can judge for ourselves. It certainly demonstrated something of the British troops' attitude to their own officers, and perhaps to the French women. So here's Mademoiselle from Armentières.
Mademoiselle from Armentières, parlez-vous. Mademoiselle from Armentières, parlez-vous. Mademoiselle from Armentières.
She hasn't been kissed in 40 years.
Hinky dinky, parlez-vous. Mademoiselle from Armentières, parlez-vous. Mademoiselle from Armentières, parlez-vous. She had four chins, her knees would knock.
And her face would stop a cuckoo clock.
Hinky dinky, parlez-vous. Mademoiselle from Armentières, parlez-vous. Mademoiselle from Armentières, parlez-vous. She could beg a franc, a drink, a meal.
But it wasn't because of her sex appeal.
Hinky dinky, parlez-vous.
The officers get the pie and cake.
Parlez-vous.
The officers get the pie and cake.
Parlez-vous. The officers get the pie and cake.
And all we get is the bellyache.
Hinky dinky, parlez-vous.
The sergeant ought to take a bath.
Parlez-vous.
The sergeant ought to take a bath.
Parlez-vous.
If he changes his underwear, the frogs will give him the croix de guerre.
Hinky dinky, parlez-vous.
You might forget the gas and shells.
Parlez-vous.
You might forget the gas and shells.
Parlez-vous. You might forget the groans and yells.
But you'll never forget the mademoiselles.
Hinky dinky, parlez-vous. Mademoiselle from Armentières, parlez-vous. Mademoiselle from Armentières, parlez-vous. Just blow your nose and dry your tears.
We'll all be back in a few short years.
Hinky.
Dinky.
Parlez-vous. Our final First World War poem is by John McCrae, a Canadian doctor who treated soldiers on the Western Front. He threw the manuscript of this great poem away after writing it, but he rescued it from the trash the next day.
It's really a call by the dead for the living not to forget those who are buried in a foreign land, to remember why they died, and of course to be sure that they did not die in vain. May 1915, in Flanders fields. In Flanders fields, the poppies blow between the crosses, row on row, that mark our place. And in the sky, the larks, still bravely singing, fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from failing hands we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields.
We're going to take a brief station break and be back with more of this special Memorial Day program, The Pity of War. Welcome back. This is Background Briefing, and we're continuing the special Memorial Day program, The Pity of War. And now, The Pity of War, poems of World War I and World War II, read by Martin Jarvis and Rosalind Ayres.
We begin our World War II selection with poet and broadcaster Henry Reed. His poem is from the point of view of a young army recruit listening to a sergeant instructing the rookies in how to deal with a rifle, even though not all the equipment seems to be available. The undertow of the text shows the contrast between the inadequate military weaponry and the seductive presence of nature itself, the soldier's loneliness, and even the absence of romance. Naming of parts.
Today, we have naming of parts. Yesterday, we had daily cleaning, and tomorrow morning, we shall have what to do after firing. But today we have naming of parts. Japonica glistens like coral in all of the neighboring gardens, and today, we have naming of parts. This is the lower sling swivel, and this is the upper sling swivel, whose use you will see when you are given your slings. And this is the piling swivel, which in your case you have not got. The branches hold in the gardens their silent, eloquent gestures, which in our case we have not got. This is the safety catch, which is always released by an easy flick of the thumb. And please do not let me see anyone using his finger. You can do it quite easy if you have any strength in your thumb. The blossoms are fragile and motionless, never letting anyone see any of them using their finger. And this, you can see, is the bolt. The purpose of this is to open the breech. As you see, we can slide it rapidly backwards and forwards. We call this easing the spring. And rapidly backwards and forwards, the early bees are assaulting and fumbling the flowers. They call it easing the spring. They call it easing the spring. It is perfectly easy if you have any strength in your thumb, like the bolt and the breech and the cocking piece and the point of balance, which in our case we have not got. And the almond blossom, silent in all of the gardens, and the bees going backwards and forwards. For today, we have naming of parts.
Keith Douglas was one of the major poets of the Second World War. He frequently wrote sheltering under his tank in the Western Desert in North Africa. His style was forensic, cynical, and often introspective. Here's How to Kill. Under the parabola of a ball, a child turning into a man, I looked into the air too long. The ball fell in my hand. It sang in the closed fist, open, open, behold, a gift designed to kill. Now in my dial of glass appears the soldier who is going to die. He smiles and moves about in ways his mother knows, habits of his. The wires touch his face. I cry, now! Death, like a familiar, hears, and look, has made a man of dust of a man of flesh. This sorcery I do. Being damned, I am amused to see the center of love diffused, and the waves of love travel into vacancy. How easy it is to make a ghost. The weightless mosquito touches her tiny shadow on the stone, and with how like, how infinite a lightness, men and shadow meet. They fuse. A shadow is a man when the mosquito death approaches.
And Keith Douglas was killed in action during the invasion of Normandy in 1944. Randall Jarrell from Nashville became a ball turret gunner in the US Air Force. That turret was in fact a plexiglass sphere set in the belly of the plane. The death of the ball turret gunner is Jarrell's most famous war poem. It seems to present the soldier almost as an innocent, placing blame for the war on the state. Here are its five telling lines. From my mother's sleep, I fell into the state, and I hunched in its belly till my wet fur froze. 6 miles from Earth, loosed from its dream of life, I woke to black flak and the nightmare fighters. When I died, they washed me out of the turret with a hose.
He didn't die then, not until the mid-1960s, in fact. In 1944, Richard Eberhardt wrote that as an American Navy officer teaching aerial gunnery, too often the names of his students turned up on death lists. This depressed him so much that he wrote, "The Fury of Aerial Bombardment." You would think the fury of aerial bombardment would rouse God to relent. The infinite spaces are still silent. He looks on shock-pride faces. History even does not know what is meant. You would feel that after so many centuries, God would give man to repent, yet he can kill, as Cain could, but with multitudinous will. No farther advanced than in his ancient furies. Was man made stupid to see his own stupidity? Is God, by definition, indifferent beyond us all? Is the eternal truth man's fighting soul, wherein the beast ravens at its own avidity? Of Van Wettering I speak, and Averill, names on a list whose faces I do not recall, but they are gone to early death, who, late in school, distinguished the belt feed lever from the belt holding pawl.
Here's the Welsh poet Dylan Thomas on the horror of a child's death in the London Blitz and his resolution to put its tragedy in perspective with countless other deaths that have gone before. He called it a refusal to mourn the death by fire of a child in London. Never until the mankind making bird, beast, and flower, fathering and all humbling darkness, tells with silence the last light breaking, and the still hour is come of the sea tumbling in harness, and I must enter again the round Zion of the water bead, and the synagogue of the ear of corn, shall I let pray the shadow of a sound, or sow my salt seed in the least valley of sackcloth, to mourn the majesty and burning of the child's death. I shall not murder the mankind of her going with a grave truth, nor blaspheme down the stations of the breath with any further elegy of innocence and youth. Deep with the first dead lies London's daughter, robed in the long friends, the grains beyond age, the dark veins of her mother, secret by the unmourning water of the riding Thames. After the first death, there is no other.
The young artist Mary Harrison served in the Women's Auxiliary Air Force. She constructed a detailed model of the city of Cologne to assist the accuracy of British bombing raids. When shown photographs of the resulting destruction, she was overcome with guilt. She wrote this poem, My Hands. Do you know what it is like to have death in your hands when you haven't a murderer's mind? Do you know how it feels when you could be the cause of a child being blind? Let me cover my eyes as you cover the skies. Let me pray it can't happen again. Don't show me the pictures you take as you fly. They're ruins and scape, little more. Is all this part of the madness we choose to call war? If there is a God up above who listens at all, does he know why this has to be? Did he give me my hands just to fashion the plans that my own land may always be free?
Like Keith Douglas, Sidney Keyes also served in North Africa. And this poem seems to sum up what all the poets that we've heard this evening are attempting in their different ways to communicate. Above all, they're desperate for their voices to be heard and for their experience to be understood. Keyes died in action on the 29th of April, April again, 1943, shortly before his 21st birthday. He'd just written this, War Poet. I am the man who looked for peace and found my own eyes barbed. I am the man who groped for words and found an arrow in my hand. I am the builder whose firm walls surround a slipping land. When I grow sick or mad, mock me not, nor chain me. When I reach for the wind, cast me not down. Though my face is a burnt book and a wasted town.
And now let's draw the threads of this evening together with a final poem, going back to where we first began, the First World War. In 1917, the British poet laureate Robert Bridges wrote a passionate verse plea, which has echoed down the years. It seems as true and vital today, as important a call for partnership and camaraderie between our two nations, as it was almost a century ago.
Bridges wrote this just after the Americans entered the First World War on April the 6th, 1917. And he called it to the United States of America.
Brothers in blood, they who this wrong began to wreck our commonwealth will rue the day when first they challenged free men to the fray. And with the Briton dared the American. Now we are pledged to win the rights of man. Labour and justice now shall have their way. And in a league of peace, God grant we may transform the earth, not patch up the old plan.
Sure is our hope, since he who led your nation spake for mankind, and ye arose in awe of that high call to work the world's salvation, clearing our minds of all estranging blindness. In the vision of beauty and the Spirit's law, freedom and honor, and sweet loving kindness.
This has been a special broadcast of Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and Claudia Bester, Head of Public Programs at the Ursula Hammer Museum. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. And now we'll close out with more of Benjamin Britten's War Requiem. Thank you.